This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest. 2, 1.
Coming up, the G8 meeting this week. Along with widespread protests, chilly relations between Vladimir Putin's Russia and the West overshadow the meeting. What's behind the cooling relationship? And what's the G8 good for anyway? We go through the pros and cons of what's sometimes called an irrelevant rich man's talking shop. France gears up for parliamentary elections on the heels of its recent presidential vote. The Dutch state is sued by the relatives of those massacred in the Bosnian town of Srebrenica 12 years ago. These stories and more on this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. At the helm in Stockholm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Great to have you with us. The G8 summit has been on the top of Europe's news agenda this week, but as the conference geared up to discuss global warming, it was widespread protests and geopolitical cooling which made the headlines. In particular, Russian President Vladimir Putin's fiery broadside at the US plans to deploy an anti-missile defense system in Eastern Europe has pundits across the continent pondering the likelihood of a new kind of Cold War. But are Putin's comments following the international or the domestic agenda? Helen Sini put that question to Deutsche Welle's Moscow correspondent Bill Gasparini.
Well, on one level, I think Russians don't really understand why the U.S. insists on placing the anti-missile system essentially right on their doorstep. Bear in mind that over the last decade, they've watched NATO expand into Eastern Europe and even former Soviet territory as defined by the Kremlin, namely the three Baltic republics. Putin's appeal stems largely from his projection of toughness and strength. And I think what the Kremlin is telling the West with this rhetoric is, we're back. We may have been down in the 90s, but no longer. His tough talk, I think, also stems from his KGB background, a reassertion of the old Soviet mindset. And Russia's vast reserves of gas and oil give him a lot of leverage over old Cold War rivals. So, of course, he's signaling messages to the West as well as to the people in Russia itself.
And yet Putin enjoys a level of public support that Western leaders can only dream about. So is such aggressive rhetoric really necessary?
Well, recent statements have been, I think, aimed at the domestic audience. Bear in mind that we're in a pre-election season here. Parliamentary vote is due in December, and then a crucial vote for a new president next March, after which Putin is due to leave office, unless he changes the constitution, which with the solid support he has in the parliament, he could do. He has repeatedly said he will be leaving office. So, in a sense, there's a bit of a succession struggle going on inside the Kremlin. Moscow political analyst Viktor Kremenyuk is with the USA Canada Institute, and he sums it up this way.
We are entering the pre-election campaign. And in this campaign, there are some points which are regarded as extremely important for the domestic consensus. Mr. Putin wants a very complicated thing. He wants to have a full-size pre-election campaign when two or more candidates will fight each other, but he doesn't wish to split the society. He wants Russia to be the robust society which shares the same values, including suspicion of the West, including hostility, slight hostility to the West.
A large current of opinion here holds that a certain fear has reasserted itself within Russia. As in Soviet times, it's best not to criticize the authorities, as your life will only get worse in the process. And I think a lot of the tough talk, especially the warlike talk recently, is because of a succession struggle underway among the powerful people around Putin within the Kremlin. Most of them are former or current members of the ex-KGB intelligence services. That may be one of the reasons why this rhetoric was as tough as it was. It may reflect that hardliners are gaining Putin's ear. These are the people who now essentially run Russia, and the world is going to have to deal with that.
Is there also a sense that Russians feel as if they're treated as a junior partner by Washington and the West?
Yes, I think there's a sense of, for lack of a better term, perhaps, a sort of kind of an inferiority complex that Russia, of course, was the last member to join what was the G7. It's now called the G8. And in fact, because of the perceived rollback of democratic reforms under President Putin, there are some leaders saying, well, Russia should not be in the club. He doesn't really belong with the other seven. And one thing that the Kremlin and a lot of Russians, too, they want respect. They want the other seven and the rest of the world to say, Russia's a major power. Russia's a major player of on the international scene, and to some extent, the other countries, the United States, Germany, other countries that are seen as really powerful, Great Britain, don't really treat Russia as an equal. But on the other hand, you can look at it the other way and say, well, if Russia's behavior was different, then maybe they would be accepted more on the same level. If what are called democratic values or the proper international relations without all kinds of using a very belligerent kind of rhetoric, of course, Russia might well be better accepted in that sense.
Well, speaking just finally of the G8, are Russians really interested in the issues that are discussed there or simply how Putin comes across and defends Russian interests?
Well, I think, of course, they watch the news reports about the G8 summit as they did last year, when, of course, the summit was held in St. Petersburg, which was a matter of great pride for Russia, even though at the time the raging war in the Middle East overshadowed events here. But in any case, they follow the news, but I wouldn't say they're all that interested in the predominant theme, which was to be climate change until all this recent rhetoric between the Russia and mostly the United States erupted, shall we say, the increasingly belligerent tone on the two sides. So I think mostly what Russians will look for with President Putin is to say, you know, he is a member of this great international club. He's there and he's projecting Russia's image, and they like that.
That was Bill Gasparini talking to Deutsche Welle's Helen Sini. Now, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel hosted this week's G8 summit. The members of the G8 take turns assuming its presidency on an annual basis. It's the presidency that sets the group's agenda for that 12 months, and the summit is the culmination of year-round conferences and policy research. But just how useful are the G8 summits, and what do they achieve? Are they worth the huge amounts of money paid out for security and infrastructure? Two of Network Europe's correspondents have different views on the worthiness of the G8. We start with Deutsche Welle's Stephen Beard, who sums up the arguments in favour of the G8.
The G8 summit usually becomes a focus for protest and discontent, and the gathering in Germany is no exception. This time, however, the criticism's been fiercer, the calls for disbandment more vociferous than before. But at this low ebb in the fortunes of the G8, it's worth remembering what it is and what it is not, and what it's achieved. It's not a world government or an attempt at one. It's not even an institutionalized body like the UN or the EU. It's a forum. It's a way for some of the richest and most powerful countries on the planet to talk and try to coordinate their policies. In this, I would argue that with many caveats and exceptions, the G8, or at least the core G7 group, has been broadly successful. Set up in the economic turmoil of the 1970s, the group did help stabilize the then new monetary system of floating exchange rates. Throughout the 1980s, it helped win the Cold War. It helped key Western democracies hold together and face down the Soviet Union. And in the 1990s, the G7 helped bring about the biggest reform of the world's trading system for 50 years. Yes, today the G8 is a mess, undermined by the unilateralism of its most powerful member, the US, riven by Russia's new aggressiveness and increasingly daunted by the huge economic growth of a non-member China. But with all its faults, I would argue it's worth preserving. It's a forum that does no harm and has done quite a lot of good. As that warrior, Winston Churchill, once said in a far more uncertain world than our own, jaw is better than war.
Deutsche Welle's Stephen Beard commenting on the merits of the G8 there. Critics of the group pointed out this week that it's hardly reassuring when one G8 member, namely Russia, says it may aim its nuclear weapons at some of the other members. Our reporter Malcolm Brabant has many more arguments as to why the G8 should be disbanded.
Here's a statistic that sums up the obscenity and hypocrisy of G8 summits. It cost $500 million to stage the G8 conference in Japan in the year 2000. That's equivalent to the annual budget of a small African nation. No doubt that sum has increased with every passing year. And for what reason? To provide a platform for some of the most unsavory characters on the planet to posture as global statesmen while lecturing the rest of us on the need to eradicate poverty and cut down on carbon emissions. The G8 leaders and their entourages of diplomats, civil servants, valets and spin doctors could save their respective taxpayers a small fortune and reduce their carbon footprint at the same time by staying at home and holding a video conference. The technology is out there and cheap at the price. They could simultaneously provide a practical demonstration in democracy by transmitting their discussions live on the internet. The reason they won't do that is because there is probably very little substance in their negotiations, because most of the agreements have been worked out in advance by civil servants. Does anyone ever remember any of the decisions made at G8 summits? I was present in Genoa in 2001, when the city was overwhelmed by running battles between the police and anti-globalization protesters. One young demonstrator was killed. His death overshadowed everything. The only memorable aspect of these jamborees is the ritual violence. In 2005, at the Gleneagles Summit in Scotland, the police spent $2 million on fencing surrounding the conference centre to keep protesters out. How many starving Africans could have been fed for that price? And that was the year the G8 leaders, under the chairmanship of Tony Blair, promised to make a pact with Africa to cancel debt and to increase international aid. According to Mark Fried, a policy director for the charity Oxfam, writing in a Scottish newspaper, the leaders of G8 don't always make good on what they promise. Nearly all the G8 countries, he said, are failing to fulfil their cash pledges made at Gleneagles. Tony Blair, soon to step down as British Prime Minister, was asked recently whether his farewell world tour was part of a vanity parade. Needless to say, he denied it. Blair said that what he despises most in the world is cynicism. What he and the rest of his colleagues would like is for the world to be more gullible. Like many of my fellow cynics, when confronted with a politician, I ask myself, why is this lying slimeball lying to me? And when faced with eight of them, that question increases exponentially. Their opportunities for grandstanding at our expense should be severely curtailed.
Deutsche Welle's correspondent Malcolm Brabant rounding up Network Europe's look at this week's G8 summit. Still ahead.
The Dutch state and United Nations are responsible for the fact that the enclave could fall and genocide could take place and therefore liable.
A shadow from the past haunts the Dutch government. You're listening to Network Europe. The French are going to the polls for the third time in less than 2 months to vote in the first round of the parliamentary elections on Sunday. France's new president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is hoping that his right-wing UMP camp will win a majority, or else he'll have to appoint a left-wing prime minister, who will then form a left-wing government. But opinion polls at the moment show that that's very unlikely. So what's at stake in these elections for France's socialists? Radio France International's Nick Champeur reports from Paris.
French people always vote for the president's camp when a parliamentary election follows a presidential poll. At least, that's what happened in 1981, 1988, and 2002. In fact, socialist leaders said publicly on several occasions that victory was not realistic. So why bother, one might ask? Former socialist finance minister Dominique Strauss-Kahn went to the 21st constituency of Paris this week to support Georges Paul Langevin, the female socialist candidate.
Absolument. Ah, oui. Bonne journée.
Ah, mais merci beaucoup. J'espère que je vais bien travailler là aujourd'hui.
Both walked up the multicultural Rue d'Avron and shook hands with locals in front of cameras and photographers. I asked Strauss-Kahn what was at stake in this election for the left.
What is at stake today is to know if there will be a rather big opposition and the possibility for democracy to work, or if we're going to have a huge majority, as is sometimes forecast by a different survey. And in this case, it would be very difficult for the opposition to make his job.
The problem is that the Socialist Party is divided and that it's doing very little to conceal the cracks. Both Strauss-Kahn and the defeated presidential candidate, Ségolène Royal, want to take over the Socialist Party, and they're not the only ones. Disputes often have to do with ego. Here in the 21st constituency, for instance, the incumbent member of parliament is a socialist. But the party has asked 65-year-old Michel Charza not to stand again in order to enable a female candidate to run. But Charza is refusing to do so. Georges Beau-Langevin, the official Socialist Party candidate, says that's not doing the party any favors.
Le Parti Socialiste m'a désigné, me soutient.
The Socialist Party chose me. There's another candidate who refuses the decision made by the party bureau. There's only one candidate running for the party, not two. There's me and one who refuses to let go.
Langevin has a strong chance of winning, but as a Socialist MP, she will probably belong to the opposition. What do opposition MPs do in France? Not much, says Gérard Grandaire, political analyst at France's Institute for Political Science in Paris.
You can talk in the assembly, talk, and say we don't agree and so on, and try to censor the government. But if they have not the majority, of course, they can do nothing about that.
And they can propose bills from time to time. They have a niche.
Yes, they can propose, but often they are not voted, of course, by the majority.
Socialist candidate Georges Beau-Langevin says, for starters, the least members of parliament should do is actually attend sessions in parliament.
We need to be vigilant, we need to be present, because it's not always been the case. On the law on France's colonial past, for instance, we've not resisted the draft because many of us didn't attend the late session on the bill. The opposition is not credible if it doesn't study bills enough, if it doesn't spend time with people to understand their problems and let them voice their grievances.
Even if the election is a landslide victory for the right and Nicolas Sarkozy, socialists will have the option to use regional councils to resist or promote their agenda locally. Following the 2004 regional elections, 21 out of France's 22 regional council presidents are socialists. If they fail to do so, if the Socialist Party is too weak, François Ehrenwein from the daily progressive Catholic paper La Croix says people will take it upon themselves to resist and engage in one of France's national sports, street demonstrations.
Dans l'hypothèse où ce pôle n'existerait pas, où la...
In a scenario where the left would be too weak to do its opposition job, too weak to represent a second pole, I think that other forms of protest would surface. I'm not praising street power. I'm not sure it's something that's good for France.
That would be in the autumn, though. French people tend to head to the beach instead of taking to the streets during the summer holidays. The second and final round of the election is on the 17th of June.
Radio France's Nick Champeau with that report. Relatives of those who were massacred in the Bosnian town of Srebrenica 12 years ago are suing the Dutch state for compensation. Dutch troops were supposed to protect the Muslims in Srebrenica, but the UN declared safe haven was overrun by Bosnian Serbs in 1995. Some 8,000 Muslim men and boys were killed by their captors after the fall of the town. Now, lawyers from their surviving relatives claim the Dutch government called off an airstrike by the United Nations, which could have prevented the massacre. And now 250 women from Srebrenica have come to The Hague in Holland to present the Dutch state with a summons. Marijke van der Berg has more.
On the square in front of the parliament, some 250 women have assembled. They're all carrying banners, and one banner is very impressive. It has a lot of names of the men they have lost. 260 women here today, all the way from Srebrenica. Dan Gerritsen, lawyer. Why do you think you have a strong case?
Well, we combined the outcomes of reports such as the United Nations report of Mr. Kofi Annan, the several rulings by the Yugoslavia Tribunal, the International Court of Justice of this year. And if you put that all together, then there is only one outcome, being that the Dutch state and United Nations are responsible for the fact that the enclave could fall and genocide could take place and therefore liable.
But the Dutch government, the military, always said we needed a backup from the air, and that never came.
Yes, that is one of the arguments that we have heard for over 12 years. However, it is clear that, first of all, it were the Dutch high-ranked officers in UNPROFOR who denied all the requests for air support when requested by Dutchbat. And after only the 8th and the 9th request did get to Mr. Janvier, who was the force commander, so the supreme commander of UNPROFOR, and he did grant the request at once. It was by intervention of the Dutch ministers that the air support was stopped.
So you're saying the Dutch are themselves responsible for not having air support?
That's correct, though politicians never mention it, but it is clear because it's in the NIOD report, it's in other reports, so it's a fact that it was on initiative of the Dutch ministers who intervened and did everything they could to stop the air support because they were afraid that the 30 Dutch batters who were taken hostage might be hurt.
One of the women tells me that it's very, very important that they are here today to make sure the Dutch government knows they still exist, knows that they still want answers. And they will continue. And they will continue to raise their voice until the Dutch government says they are wrong and that they are sorry.
Radio Netherlands, Marijke van der Bij with that report. As always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can by logging on to our website at www.networkeurope.org. And so that you don't ever miss a Network Europe broadcast again, you'll find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. In the meantime, we love to get feedback on our programs from our listeners. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas, and criticisms to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That address again, it's contact@networkeurope.org. Well, that's all we have time for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Polish Radio External Service, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. I'll leave you this week with this track, Release Me, by Swedish band Olora. Network Europe will be back, of course, next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins saying thanks for joining us.
I am the wilderness locked in a cage. I am a growing force you kept in place. I am a tree reaching for the sun. Please don't hold me down. Please don't hold me down. I am a rolling wave without the motion. A glass of water longing for the ocean. I am an asphalt flower breaking free, but you keep stopping me. Release me. Release me. Yourself from with the rules.